Dracula. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Dracula. Last time, we were listening, obviously, to the second half of Chapter 17. And here's a quick summary, not of my own. I'm nicking this from a website called Schmoop. A quick summary of what happened then in the last part of Chapter 17. Here we go. Before coming to London to meet Mina and the others, Jonathan had gone to Whitby to ask about the cargo that the Count had shipped to Carfax in London. The cargo amounted to 50 boxes of common earth to be used for experimental purposes. No one was able to tell him any more about the cargo, although everyone had something to say about the strange ship that entered the harbour during the storm with a dead guy steering it. Jonathan Harker's journal, September 30th. Next, Jonathan goes to London to make sure that all 50 boxes were indeed delivered to Carfax, and they were. And then we have Mina's journal, September 30th. Mina is happy to see Jonathan so determined and brave. Quincy Morris and Arthur have arrived. Mina gives them each a copy of the documents to read over. Arthur has a good cry on her shoulder before he reads it. After all, he's just been with the guys since Lucy died, and he likes having a female shoulder to cry on. Mina has only just met Arthur, but she doesn't mind acting all motherly with him, and she offers to let Quincy Morris have a good cry too, but he declines, because after all, he's a manly American. That's what it says here on Schmoop, anyway. So, that's what happened in the last episode. Now we move on to the new chapter, Chapter 18. Oh my goodness. Now, before we do that, I just need to go to the appendices of the Penguin edition. Do you know I actually lost my Penguin edition recently? I don't know where it is. It's probably in the house somewhere. But I need it for this purpose, so I went out and bought another one. See, devotion to duty. Here we go, chapter 18. Now, this is some Latin, ladies and gentlemen, so this does take a little bit of an explanation. In the text, you will hear this phrase, non cause, which is Latin for there is no reason, and ignoratio elenchi. Now, this is a purported refutation of a proposition that does not, in fact, prove it false, but merely establishes a related but strictly irrelevant proposition. The next one, and the last one you'll be glad to hear, is the vendor of a certain nostrum. Both of these phrases, actually, are said by Renfield. The vendor of a certain nostrum. Stoker is probably referring to Clark's world-famed blood mixture, a commercial cure-all of the late Victorian period, claiming to cleanse the blood from all impurities, and which used the advertising slogan, "For the blood is the life." And that's it. So, now we can move swiftly on to Chapter 18, Part 1 of
Dracula by Bram Stoker. Read by Mike Bennett.
Episode 27. Chapter 18. Dr. Seward's Diary. 30 September. I got home at 5 o'clock and found that Godalming and Morris had not only arrived, but had already studied the transcript of the various diaries and letters which Harker and his wonderful wife had made and arranged. Harker had not yet returned from his visit to the carrier's men, of whom Dr. Hennessy had written to me. Mrs. Harker gave us a cup of tea, and I can honestly say that for the first time since I have lived in it, this old house seemed like home. When we finished, Mrs. Harker said, "Dr. Seward, may I ask a favour? I want to see your patient, Mr. Renfield. Do let me see him. What you have said of him in your diary interests me so much." She looked so appealing and so pretty that I could not refuse her, and there was no possible reason why I should. So I took her with me. When I went into the room, I told the man that a lady would like to see him, to which he simply answered, "Why, she is going through the house and wants to see everyone in it," I answered. "Oh, very well," he said. "Let her come in, by all means, but just wait till I tidy up the place." His method of tidying was peculiar. He simply swallowed all the flies and spiders in the boxes before I could stop him. It was quite evident that he feared, or was jealous of, some interference. When he had got through his disgusting task, he said cheerfully, "Let the lady come in." and sat down on the edge of his bed with his head down, but with his eyelids raised so that he could see her as she entered. For a moment I thought he might have some homicidal intent. I remembered how quiet he had been just before he attacked me in my own study, and I took care to stand where I could seize him at once if he attempted to make a spring at her. She came into the room with an easy gracefulness which would at once command the respect of any lunatic, for easiness is one of the qualities mad people most respect. She walked over to him, smiling pleasantly, and held out her hand. "Good evening, Mr. Renfield," said she. "You see, I know you, for Dr. Seward has told me of you." He made no immediate reply, but eyed her all over intently with a set frown on his face. This look gave way to one of wonder, which merged into doubt. Then, to my intense astonishment, he said, "You're not the girl the doctor wanted to marry, are you? You can't be, you know, for she's dead." Mrs. Harker smiled sweetly as she replied, "Oh, no, I have a husband of my own, to whom I was married before I ever saw Dr. Seward, or he me. I am Mrs. Harker."
"Then what are you doing here?"
"My husband and I are staying on a visit with Dr. Seward."
"Then don't stay."
"But why not?"
I thought that this style of conversation might not be pleasant to Mrs. Harker, any more than it was to me, so I joined in.
"How do you know I wanted to marry anyone?"
His reply was simply contemptuous, given in a pause in which he turned his eyes from Mrs. Harker to me, instantly turning them back again. What an asinine question.
"I don't see that at all, Mr. Renfield," said Mrs. Harker, at once championing me. He replied to her with as much courtesy and respect as he had shown contempt to me.
"You will, of course, understand, Mrs. Harker, that when a man is so loved and honoured as our host is, everything regarding him is of interest in our little community. Dr. Seward is loved not only by his household and his friends, but even by his patients, who, being some of them hardly in mental equilibrium, are apt to distort causes and effects. Since I myself have been an inmate of a lunatic asylum, I cannot but notice that the sophistic tendencies of some of its inmates lean towards the errors of non causa and ignoratio elenchi." I positively opened my eyes at this new development. Here was my own pet lunatic, the most pronounced of his type that I had ever met with, talking elemental philosophy and with the manner of a polished gentleman. I wonder if it was Mrs. Harger's presence which had touched some chord in his memory. If this new phase was spontaneous or in any way due to her unconscious influence, she must have some rare gift or power. We continued to talk for some time, and seeing that he was seemingly quite reasonable, she ventured, looking at me questioningly as she began, to lead him to his favourite topic. I was again astonished, for he addressed himself to the question with the impartiality of the completest sanity. He even took himself as an example when he mentioned certain things.
"Why, I myself am an instance of a man who had a strange belief. Indeed, it was no wonder that my friends were alarmed and insisted on my being put under control. I used to fancy that life was a positive and perpetual entity, and that by consuming a multitude of live things, no matter how low in the scale of creation, one might indefinitely prolong life. At times I held the belief so strongly that I actually tried to take human life. The doctor here will bear me out that on one occasion I tried to kill him for the purpose of strengthening my vital powers by the assimilation with my own body of his life through the medium of his blood, relying, of course, upon the scriptural phrase, 'For the blood is the life.' Though, indeed, the vendor of a certain nostrum has vulgarized the truism to the point of contempt. Isn't that true, Doctor?" I nodded assent, for I was so amazed that I hardly knew what to either think or say. It was hard to imagine that I had seen him eat up his spiders and flies not 5 minutes before. Looking at my watch, I saw that I should go to the station to meet Van Helsing, so I told Mrs. Harker that it was time to leave. She came at once, after saying pleasantly to Mr. Renfield, "Goodbye, and I hope I may see you often, under auspices pleasanter to yourself."
To which, to my astonishment, he replied, "Goodbye, my dear. I pray God I may never see your sweet face again. May he bless and keep you."
When I went to the station to meet Van Helsing, I left the boys behind me. Poor Art seemed more cheerful than he has been since Lucy first took ill, and Quincy is more like his own bright self than he has been for many a long day. Van Helsing stepped from the carriage with the eager nimbleness of a boy. He saw me at once and rushed up to me, saying,
"Ah, friend John, how goes all? Well, so, I have been busy, for I come here to stay if need be. All affairs are settled with me, and I have much to tell. Madam Mina is with you? Yes, and her so fine husband? And Arthur and my friend Quincy, they are with you too? Good."
As I drove to the house, I told of what had passed, and of how my own diary had come to be of some use through Mrs. Harker's suggestion, at which the professor interrupted me.
"Ah, that wonderful Madam Mina! She has a man's brain. A brain that a man should have, were he much gifted, and a woman's heart. The good God fashioned her for a purpose, believe me, when he made that so good combination. A friend John, up to now, fortune has made that woman of help to us. After tonight, she must not have to do with this so terrible affair. It is not good that she run the risk so great. We men are determined, nay, are we not pledged, to destroy this monster. But it is no part for a woman. Even if she be not harmed, her heart may fail her in so much and so many horrors, and hereafter she may suffer, both in waking from her nerves and in sleep from her dreams. And besides, she is young woman and not so long married. There may be other things to think of some time, if not now. You tell me she has wrote all. Then she must consult with us. But then, tomorrow, she say goodbye to this work and we go alone." I agreed heartily with him, and then I told him what we had found in his absence, that the house which Dracula had bought was the very next one to my own. He was amazed, and a great concern seemed to come on him. "Oh, that we had known it before," he said, "for then we might have reached him in time to save poor Lucy. However, the milk that is spilt cries not out afterwards, as you say. We shall not think of that, but go on our way to the end." Then he fell into a silence that lasted till we entered my own gateway. Before we went to prepare for dinner, he said to Mrs. Harker, "I am told, Madam Mina, by my friend John, that you and your husband have put up in exact order all the things that have been up to this moment."
"Not up to this moment, Professor," she said impulsively, "but up to this morning."
"But why not up to now? We have seen hitherto how good light all the little things have made. We have told our secrets, and yet no one who has told is the worse for it."
Mrs. Harker began to blush, and taking a paper from her pockets, she said, "Dr. Van Helsing, will you read this and tell me if it must go in? It is my record of today. I too have seen the need of putting down at present everything, however trivial, but there is little in this except what is personal. Must it go in?" The professor read it over gravely and handed it back, saying,
"It need not go in if you do not wish it, but I pray that it may. It can but make your husband love you the more, and all us, your friends, more honour you, as well as more esteem and love."
She took it back with another blush and a bright smile. And so now, up to this very hour, all the records we have are complete and in order. The professor took away one copy to study after dinner and before our meeting, which is fixed for 9 o'clock. The rest of us have already read everything, so when we meet in the study, we shall all be informed as to facts and can arrange our plan of battle with this terrible and mysterious enemy. Mina Harker's Journal, 30 September.
When we met in Dr. Seward's study 2 hours after dinner, which had been at 6 o'clock, we unconsciously formed a sort of board or committee. Professor Van Helsing took the head of the table, to which Dr. Seward motioned him as he came into the room. He made me sit next to him on his right and asked me to act as secretary. Jonathan sat next to me. Opposite us were Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward and Mr. Morris. Lord Godalming was next to the professor and Dr. Seward in the centre. The professor said, "I may, I suppose, take it that we are all acquainted with the facts that are in these papers?" We all expressed assent, and he went on. "Then it were, I think, good that I tell you something of the kind of enemy with which we have to deal. I shall then make known to you something of the history of this man, which has been ascertained for me. So then we can discuss how we shall act, and can take our measure according. There are such beings as vampires. Some of us have evidence that they exist. Even had we not the proof of our own unhappy experience, the teachings and the records of the past give proof enough for sane peoples. I admit that at the first I was sceptic. Were it not that through long years I have trained myself to keep an open mind, I could not have believed until such time as that fact thunder on my ear. See, see, I prove, I prove. Alas, had I known at the first what now I know, nay, had I even guessed at him, one so precious life had been spared to many of us who did love her. But that is gone, and we must so work that other poor souls perish not whilst we can save. The Nosferatu do not die like the bee when he sting once. He is only stronger, and being stronger have yet more power to work evil. This vampire which is amongst us is of himself so strong in person as 20 men. He is of cunning more than mortal, for his cunning be the growth of ages. He have still the aids of necromancy, which is, as his etymology imply, the divination by the dead, and all the dead that he can come nigh to are for him at command. He is brute, and more than brute, he is devil in callous, and the heart of him is not. He can, within limitations, appear at will, when and where, and in any of the forms that are to him. He can, within his range, direct the elements, the storm, the fog, the thunder. He can command all the meaner things, the rat and the owl and the bat, the moth and the fox and the wolf. He can grow and become small, and he can at times vanish and come unknown. How, then, are we to begin our strike to destroy him? How shall we find his where? And having found it, how can we destroy? My friends, this is much. It is a terrible task that we undertake, and there may be consequence to make the brave shudder. For if we fail in this our fight, he must surely win. And then where end we? Life is nothings. I heed him not. But to fail here is not mere life or death. It is that we become as him, that we henceforward become foul things of the night, like him, without heart or conscience, preying on the bodies and the souls of those we love best. To us forever are the gates of heaven shut. For who shall open them to us again? We go on for all time, abhorred by all, a blot on the face of God's sunshine, an arrow in the side of him who died for man. But we are face to face with duty, and in such case must we shrink? For me, I say no, but then I am old, and life, with his sunshine, his fair places, his song of birds, his music and his love, lie far behind. You, others, are young. Some have seen sorrow, but there are fair days yet in store. What say you?"
Whilst he was speaking, Jonathan had taken my hand. I feared, oh so much, that the appalling nature of our danger was overcoming him when I saw his hand stretch out. But it was life to me to feel its touch, so strong, so self-reliant, so resolute. A brave man's hand can speak for itself. It does not even need a woman's love to hear its music. When the professor had done speaking, my husband looked in my eyes and I in his. There was no need for speaking between us. "I answer for Mina and myself," he said.
"Count me in, Professor,"
said Mr. Quincey Morris, laconically as usual.
"I am with you," said Lord Godalming, "for Lucy's sake, if for no other reason."
Dr. Seward simply nodded. The professor stood up and, after laying his golden crucifix on the table, held out his hand on either side. I took his right hand and Lord Godalming his left. Jonathan held my right with his left and stretched across to Mr. Morris. So, as we all took hands, our solemn compact was made. I felt my heart icy cold, but it did not even occur to me to draw back. We resumed our places, and Dr. Van Helsing went on with a sort of cheerfulness which showed that the serious work had begun. It was to be taken as gravely and in as businesslike a way as any other transaction of life.
The music on the podcast is by Andrew Rothman. For more information, go to arothman.com.
And so there we are, ladies and gentlemen. That was indeed part one of Dracula, chapter... which one was it? 18. Yes. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, I have to go now because I've got two dogs downstairs. I think you may have noticed in my Patreon feed, I talked about the fact we've got this new dog. He's a lovely little boy, but there are some problems. The initial problem was, not adjusting. It wasn't his fault. It was our other dog, Pippa. She was kind of rejecting him. But now she seems to have accepted him, which is a good thing. But the bad thing is, if I leave them alone, they're constantly into this sort of rough and tumble game, and they're rolling around knocking things over and breaking things, and especially in the garden, because you think, oh, you put the dogs out in the garden. It's a beautiful summer day. And we've been kind of spoiled, really, because Pippa is such a lovely, natured, gentle dog that she wouldn't harm or damage a thing. But since, little Mr. Rough and Tumble has arrived, things are getting broken. Quite a lot of things, actually. Plants, I should emphasise, they're not breaking like glass urns or china or whatever else, So I don't want to leave them downstairs too long. And the other thing is he's peeing in the house, which I'm not too crazy about either. And the worst thing, sorry to go on about this, but, it's my life. So the other thing is he's got a terrible habit. If you let him off the lead, he's great. He's playing with Pippa. He's playing with me or Pauline. But if he sees anybody, if he sees a person, if he sees a kid or a kid on a bike, anything, basically, boom, he's gone. He shoots off at 1,000 miles an hour and he's all over them. And he's really annoying because he sort of jumps up and he's got these long claws, which I'm trying to get cut, but they're far too long and you have to sort of cut them very gradually. And people, don't know what to make of it. And probably some people are a bit frightened and unhappy about it. So I'm going to have to put him on a lead all the time when we take him out, which is a great pity because he's got so much energy. And apparently the thing you do about this kind of a problem is burn all that energy off. How can I burn the energy off if I've got to keep him on a lead? Oh, boy. Listen, sorry to bore you with that. I've got to go downstairs and make sure they're not, breaking the house. But that's life, isn't it? Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And I look forward to seeing you again in the Hall of Mirrors very soon. And, of course, Underwood and Flinch if you're at the $3 level later on this month. Thank you very much. Pip, pip, and cheerio.
MikeBennettAuthor.com